Welcome to our latest Slightly Foxed podcast. My name's Rosie Goldsmith and I'm delighted to be steering you through the history of one of the most outrageous, controversial, eccentric, influential, glamorous and intriguing families of the 20th century, the Mitfords. If you're a regular listener, you'll know that on this podcast we quite often resurrect literary greats who for various reasons have dropped out of the spotlight, but the Mitfords are the opposite. They continue to fascinate us, not only thanks to the witty novels and letters they wrote, but everything that is written about them. Rarely a year goes by without another Mitford documentary or film or TV series or volume of letters or biography. There's always something new to say about them. And that's exactly why we've invited two modern Mitfordians, if that's the right word for them, onto the show to look at their literary output and legacy, and for the very first time to focus on the mother of the family, Sydney. So welcome to Rachel Trethewey, biographer and historian and author of, to my mind, a groundbreaking new biography of Sydney Mitford. And the book is called Muv, and that was her nickname. And to Frances Donnelly, a writer and broadcaster and, I would say, Mitford enthusiast, if not more accurately, besotted fan. So welcome to you both. Start us off, why are you both so interested in the Mitfords? Rachel.
I fell in love with the Mitfords when I was a teenager reading Nancy's books, and I think they're just so fun and full of humour and glamour. And I think at that age, you want to be part of that girl gang. You want to be at Alconley with the Radlets. And then as I got older, I became more interested as well in the politics around them and reading the biographies. And through that, I began to think, I want to know more about the mother. She's the central figure there.
Brilliant. And I think you definitely put it into a very, very good summary also for me there. Frances?
Well, I suppose I fell in love with Nancy's books when I was a teenager. And while I have a more muted response now to Nancy's books, the family do continue to enthral. I think it's because the allegiances within the family span the politics of the early 20th century so acutely, and one still thinks about it and, well, now think about Muv, really trying to keep an unruly group of girls meshed into politics and really trying to be a good mother and at the same time keep them under control.
Well, thank you both very much for whetting our appetites. And I'm really looking forward to navigating the Mitford mythology with you both. But first, we have, as always, a short catch-up with our editors and publishers of Slightly Fox, Gail Perkis and Hazelwood. Hello to both of you.
Okay.
It's been an unbelievable 3 months since we all sat round the table here at Slightly Foxed. What's been happening and what's ahead for Slightly Fox? Gail.
Well, Hazel and I did an appearance at a literary festival in Barnsbury in North London in April. It's the first festival they had organised there, and it was lovely. We had lots of subscribers.
What's the name of the festival?
The Barnsbury Literary Festival.
That's a good, clear description.
So it was
name
in,
and
in
title.
In the public library, and that was a very jolly occasion, a nice sunny day.
One of those nice sort of little literary festivals that we rather enjoy.
But Hazel and I are now knee-deep in autumn publications. So issue 91 is full of lovely things, isn't it, Hazel?
It is indeed.
Hazel, what's in the upcoming magazine?
Well, we have a lovely piece by Frances, who's here with us today, about James Lees Milne's diaries.
This is going to be so useful also for this podcast.
Yes, who had connections with the Mitfords.
I should say. Slept with the brother and was in love with Diana. That's a pretty close connection.
Indeed, indeed. Yes, yes.
Doesn't always entitle you to write about them.
And James himself was just such a fascinating diarist, and the man really who started the National Trust.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You know, all the legwork for it.
Yes, yes.
Fascinating. We also have a very funny piece about a book called The Specialist, which is actually about how to build a privy. It's quite a famous book, but it's sort of fallen out of fashion. But it's
the privy or the
well, both really. A piece about the Victorian Birds of London by W.H. Hudson, which is quite fascinating, really. And
with illustrations for that?
A couple of illustrations. Mm. Some very sooty-looking crows perched on the chimney pot.
I'm surprised they survived in London.
Yes, and we have Monica Dickens. We also have George Eliot, Scenes from Clerical Life, Imperfect Priests. So it's a lovely bran tub, as usual.
Absolutely. What a treasure trove. And Frances, you're in good company, I think, with all those other essays and stories. Wonderful. Any more news?
Well, we've also, in issue 91, got a lovely article about a biography, autobiography, by R.C. Sheriff, who wrote the play Journey's End. And we are reissuing that book in two volumes, because it's a long book, in September. And it is an extraordinary and very gripping account of how he came to write the play. In later life, it was about the only thing that people remembered him for, but in actual fact, he became an incredibly highly paid and highly regarded screenwriter in Hollywood and wrote the scripts for The Dam Busters, Goodbye Mr. Chips, Mrs. Miniver, I mean, a lot of, you know, iconic films. But he was a very modest man. It's a long book. I've now read it three times, and even on the third reading, I'm still really enjoying it. So,
And what else have we got on the agenda?
Well, we have our Reader's Day coming up, which is on the 24th of October. Still a few tickets left. And we've got a really interesting lineup, I think. We've got Ben Okri, of course, well-known novelist, travel writer Sarah Wheeler, Tom Hodgkinson, who's the editor of The Idler, and Julian Evans, who's been on our podcast. So it's a very jolly occasion with cake and Madeira to end.
So I look forward to it very much indeed. I will be there. Before I let you two go, I know you're staying for the whole podcast, but just briefly, how do you both stand on the Mitfords? Because people always have opinions on the Mitfords. Gail?
Well, like Rachel and Frances, I loved Nancy Mitford's novels and I still enjoy reading them. Jessica Mitford, we reissued her memoir of her family as a Slightly Fox edition, and it is a lovely book. I do rather lose patience with her later writing, I have to say. I think she must have been the most difficult of them all. But I also love Deb O'Devonshire, wrote some very short books, Counting My Chickens, which is hilarious. And I sort of feel that she was a writer monkey. I mean, she obviously had lots of other things to do at Chatsworth, but given the chance, she certainly could turn a phrase.
Mm. And chickens. I'm surprised that nobody's written a book about the Mitfords and chickens.
Yes, because
there are so many chickens in Mitford's stories and in their lives. Hazel, what about you? How do you feel about the Mitfords?
Well, I suppose, like everybody, I do think that the two Nancy novels are, you know, quite fantastic, actually, and reading them after quite a long time.
Like everybody.
No, I'm sorry, but actually I was just blown away by her. She's such a stylist, isn't she? But not just a stylist. I think I was a bit Mitforded out at one point, you know, because I had all the letters. I did look at those and felt a little bit sort of exhausted, but I do love Nancy's writing, and Jessica as well in a different way. So, yes, I'm keen.
Well, I think you're going to all enjoy this discussion about the Mitfords. Now, the story of the Mitford family is so rich and so complex that I thought I'd start with a quick who's who before we dig down deep. It all began with the marriage in 1904 of Sidney Bowles and David Mitford, later to become Lady and Lord Reedsdale, Baron Reedsdale. Between 1904 and 1920, they had seven children. Six girls and one boy, Tom. The six girls were Nancy, the oldest, who we've been talking a little bit about, known for her novels and biographies, especially her humorous novels of aristocratic life between the wars, The Pursuit of Love and Love in a Cold Climate. Pamela, number two, to my great relief, led a much quieter life. Diana, on the other hand, was rarely out of the news, a glamorous socialite, a fascist and friend of Hitler. She married the founder and leader of the British Union, a fascist, Oswald Mosley. Unity, number four, took fascism and Hitler obsession even further. She stalked Hitler in the 1930s, there's no other word for it, became his friend and shot herself in the head when Britain declared war on Germany.
Jessica, known as Decca, like Nancy, was a writer and the only communist in the family. Her memoir, we've just been hearing a little bit about it, Hons and Rebels, is in a gorgeous, slightly foxed edition and is her best-known book. She later emigrated to California, achieving fame as a campaigning journalist and civil rights activist. And Deborah, or Debo, the youngest, became the Duchess of Devonshire and Chatelaine of Chatsworth House, surely one of this country's most beautiful historic houses, and lots of nodding there as well. Now, the siblings, of course, form only part of the Mitford story, and I'd like to bring in Rachel again to talk about their mother, Sydney. Rachel, now your very magnificent biography of Sydney came out last year, and I thought then when I read it, at last I'll be able to understand how and why the Mitford sisters ticked. I didn't know very much about their mother and what role their mother played in shaping their lives, their creativity and their politics. And finally, thanks to you, I think I do. Now, unbelievably, this is the first biography of Sydney, and you've called it Muv. So why did you write it?
Well, I think I'd loved Nancy's novels when I was young and it appealed to a teenager. But as I got older and read biographies of the Mitfords and all the letters, as you've spoken about, I began to think, what about the mother? And when I had a child of my own, I thought even more about that, because it was so exciting for the girls. But what was it like being the person who had to sort of police them and be in charge of that? And as I began to delve into Lady Reedsdale, I became more and more interested, and particularly in the politics of the 1930s. And I feel that's sort of been airbrushed out of Nancy's novels. The character based on Lady Reedsdale in Nancy's The Pursuit of Love and Love in Cold Climates, Aunt Sadie, and she's this really vague, rather boring character compared to Uncle Matthew or Favre. You know, she just sort of languidly drifts around doing nothing much and is just vague. Well, Lady Reedsdale wasn't at all like that. And the more I read about her, the more I just felt she shaped them, that the politics came from her. She was very influenced by her father, Thomas Gibson Bowles, who was this complete maverick with some very weird, extreme views on a lot of things, from food to healthcare to politics, where he kept sort of changing sides. And also, I think she did shape their writing. They always complained that she was a Philistine, and they complained that, certainly Jessica and Nancy complained that they didn't have a good education. But in fact, my research showed that Lady Reedsdale made sure they had a very thorough education. And I think the proof of the pudding's in the eating. Four of them became excellent writers.
Mm. You call her Lady Reedsdale, and the book is called Muv, which was her nickname, and her actual name was Sydney. Mm. So I think maybe we'll just call her Sydney.
Sydney.
Let's be familiar.
Yes, absolutely.
I hope she won't mind.
No, she might.
She might.
And she'd tell us.
Yes, she certainly would. You know, you brought up a few. She's a very divisive character. Mm. And, you know, there are so many dichotomies, really. There's the mother or the manager, and the girls, whether in their letters or their books, are always trying to work out who she really is. So, I mean, do you feel generally that you do know who she really is now? And you obviously have respect for her, but I imagine also some reservations.
Absolutely. I found it a really interesting biography to write. I've never been so divided about someone I'm writing about, because I admired her as a mother and her resilience. She lost two of her children and she survived some terrible things, but I absolutely loathed her politics, because the thing we can't get away from is she supported Hitler not just before the war, which a lot of English aristocrats did, but also during and after the war. And getting my head around that was incredibly difficult. I don't think anyone ever got their head around her politics completely. It was very like Diana's.
Now, you called her the original Mitford girl. So let's go way back a little bit and try and describe her life, because it is really, it's original research and it's really a fascinating book. So tell us more about her early life and what shaped her.
Well, her early life was actually much more exciting than her daughter's. And she gave her daughters this very stable upbringing, probably because hers was so rackety. She lost her mother when she was only 7 years old, and her father, this maverick, charismatic publisher and politician Thomas Gibson Bowles, brought her up. And so he took his two young daughters sailing on the Nereid, his boat, and it was an amazing trip. They nearly drowned several times. They were on a small ship for nearly a year, and Sydney just sort of coped with it all. She became very detached, very calm. And she then came home to London, and her father put her in charge of his household at only 14 years old. So she learned at a very early age to have responsibility and to deal with the staff. She had some falling out with the male staff. So after that, she'd only have women as her employees. And actually, Jessica said, having power at such an early age made her very bossy. The problem was, though, she didn't have a mother's touch. And I think that's really important in the whole story of Lady Reedsdale. Until she was 18, her father kept her dressed in a sailor suit. And it was only when a female friend of his said, you know, if she's going on to the marriage market, I think she needs something a bit more alluring than a sort of thick serge sailor suit to wear. So I think her child was absolutely formative. And I think the thing we have to hold on to is the lack of having a mother. That made it hard for her to know exactly how to mother her own daughters.
Where did you find all this information about Sidney? I mean, were there letters? Was she herself writing diaries as well? Because that's one thing, again, we don't know about her. Was she a writer? Did she influence girls, you know, in her writing too?
Well, she did write a biography. She wrote one called Five Houses because for Sidney, she was very good at interior design, which actually went on to the Duchess of Devonshire.
And Chatsworth House.
At Chatsworth. And so houses were really important to her. And she was really sad that she didn't have the thing that most aristocrats had of keeping one house for the whole of their lives. Anyway, so she called her biography after that. Sadly, we can't see the biography. Most of the Mitford papers are kept at Chatsworth and they're embargoed until 2063. The Duchess of Devonshire decided on that. But fortunately, the red sheep of the family, Jessica, kept her own papers and her letters with Mav, and they were the source I was able to use. And they're in America. And I read hundreds of letters between Jessica and Sidney, and they're the ones that gave me a real insight into her as a mother. It doesn't talk about her politics, but it gave me a real feel of what she was like. And I liked her in that way, which shocked me to a degree because I was so horrified by her politics.
Mm, which we'll talk about a little bit more later. But the nicknames, Muv and Farv and Decker and all these other names that they all gave each other, and Hons and so on, and the different languages the children spoke to each other, and Honish and so on. I mean, there's a whole new vocabulary there for people if they're interested in the Mitfords. Did you write yourself a vocabulary list?
I think I can't even remember all the nicknames. They had so many and they couldn't remember why they called each other things half the time. But Jessica, I think, put it very clearly that they were almost like a lost tribe because they all stuck together and they talked in this thing called Bowdlerdidge. They had names like the nickname for Tom, the only boy, was Tudmy, which was another word for adultery. And that was one of the few things Lady Reedsdale, or Sidney as we're calling her, really objected to in Decker's book on some rebels, that Tom was called Tudamy in that because she didn't want him associated with anything negative.
But Muv and Farv. Now, Muv and Farv, in other words, Lord and Lady Reedsdale, they met at a very young age. She was 14, he was 17, but they got married later. What was their marriage like and how did they live? Because they didn't have very much money.
They didn't have very much money by aristocratic standards.
Okay, so they did have a lot of money.
Well, I mean, even when they, near the end, sort of said they didn't have much money, you know, they were living with a London townhouse in Knightsbridge with a ballroom. So it is all comparative. And, you know, they had a estate up in Scotland, but they felt they didn't have much money. And Sidney was actually really good at handling finances and money, but Lord Reedsdale was pretty useless and he wanted to be an entrepreneur, but he had the opposite of a Midas touch. So they'd go out to Canada and prospect for gold, and poor old Lord Reedsdale managed to find the one place where there wasn't gold. The next door estate, which belonged to Harry Oakes, was the biggest gold mine in the world. And, you know, he was just a mile away. It was a complicated marriage. I mean, Farv had a very bad temper and he also wasn't as cultural as Lady Reedsdale. She tried to introduce him to novels and he just wasn't interested. I mean, she got him to read Tess of the D'Urbervilles. But once she told him that it wasn't a true story, it was just fiction, he was horrified and said he'd never bother with a novel again.
So he didn't read Nancy's, or did he read...
Did he?
He read more than the girls would admit, and in letters there's him saying, oh, you know, I've been reading this book. He wasn't a bookish man, we can say that, but he did read Nancy's books, and I think he rather liked the portrayal of him as Uncle Matthew. He said to his wife, I didn't know I was that fierce, but he wasn't as offended by it as Sydney was. Sydney was more worried about, oh, what will people think about this? Whereas he rather revelled in this loving portrayal of him, really, as Uncle Matthew.
The other aspect, I think, which is really interesting, is the fact that the girls did not have any formal education. Nevertheless, they became really, you know, brilliant literary minds and writers and, you know, very creative, all of them. How do you explain that? And who did teach them?
I think in a way, because it was forbidden fruit learning, it made them want it more. And they were privileged to have an absolutely brilliant library. And they were given free range there. Their grandfather, Reedsdale, Bertie Mitford, had collected one of the best libraries. And they could spend hours there reading things that probably weren't age appropriate at all. And Sydney taught them for the first 6 to 8 years of their life. And she was actually a really good teacher. And she said it was one of the most valuable things she ever did in her life. And by the age of 6, her test of whether they could read or not was, could they read The Times Leader? So that's what they had to aim for. They were then allowed to study various things with very weird governesses. Some of them were good, some of them were bad. One apparently only taught them how to shoplift. But others, you know...
Rachel, so much incredible
you know, just was normal. You know, it just, I mean, it's just everything was extreme and eccentric. And then they'd have a French mademoiselle over to teach them French because it was felt that girls should have a smattering of French and to learn to play the piano and to dance. But for Jessica and Nancy, it just wasn't enough. And Jessica said she'd have liked to be a scientist. Mm. Whether that was true or not, I don't know. And we might have missed out on some very good books if she had become that.
Now, Frances, as a paid-up Mitfordian, is that the right word?
Actually? I think it's nice. Let's keep it anyway, even if it's not.
Well, as a dedicated Mitfordian, you've read Marv as well. You've read the biography.
Absolutely, and admired it greatly. I thought I did know the whole story, and I absolutely did not.
What did you discover?
Well, to go back slightly further than you have done, I was fascinated that what was essentially the grandfather of the Mitford girls, the publisher, who founded Vanity Fair and The Lady. You know, there was writing there in the family. But I was immensely touched. He was illegitimate.
Sydney's father was illegitimate.
That's right. And it wasn't. The girls certainly didn't know. And for that reason, knowing his background, he always thought of himself as an outsider who was perfectly entitled to own his own opinions. And I think that's a trait that went straight down the line into the girls. People always remark on the extraordinary confidence of the Mitford girls. The mother had it, and I think she got it from this father, who, as I say, whose background was not at all what it appeared to be. That was completely new to me. I was astounded by that. I feel strongly for Mav insofar as if you've got 7 children, you'll get it very right for perhaps 3 of them and very wrong for 4. And you do the best you can. And as you hear about their education, how they were brought up, there's a terrifying sensation of a ticking time bomb is going here, because you know what the effect of that education, or lack of it, will have on some of the girls, whereas the others, Pam and Debo and Unity, loved country life and would have been perfectly happy to have stayed there. The other 4 wanted adventures, and my goodness, they found them.
Mm. I mean, it's, you know, with 7 children, of course, all of them are going to be very, very different. But nevertheless, they do have several traits which do make them very much of the Mitford family. And I wonder whether that reading Mav helped you to understand the whole family.
It did, and I think their mother set the tone for them completely. Her confidence, her absolute belief that she knew what was right and wrong. Now, this translated itself into some pretty terrible things in some of the children who did not waver in their ghastly opinions. I think the main problem was they never met anybody else, and I think that's at the number of it. The views of the mother were never challenged in the home. So when they went into the outside world, they weren't cowed. They just thought everyone else was wrong and went on with this great certainty of purpose.
Now, one writer and one character in this story who you know Francis very well because you've read a lot about him and by him is James Lees Milne. And tell us about his role in the family, because it's not just a literary role, it's also...
Not exactly.
But yes, tell us more about James Lees Milne.
He loved Tom and had a passionate affair with him.
So he was a friend of the family.
Yes. And he was dazzled by them, but they were dazzling. You can never underestimate the effect of physical beauty on people. And the family had more than their fair share. They were, most of them, stunning-looking in different ways. And I won't say his head was turned, but he was captivated by them. He was very fond of Nancy, who, though a marvellously funny and witty person, was, I think, quite a handful in conversation. And
I think the word is cruel.
I was fighting shy of that, and yet it's true.
And I said it.
It was true. And she always claimed that her cruelty came from never having been loved, as it were, by her mother.
Rachel, did you want to jump in there quickly?
There's a wonderful quote from James about that. He said that there was a streak of callousness in Nancy, which almost amounted to cruelty. And he said, actually, that's in all the Mitfords, even Tom. And I think that is true. And it comes out in their politics and sometimes in how they handle each other. And even in Nancy's writing sometimes, you know, there's this line or two about when Polly Hampton in Love in a Cold Climate gives birth, and she's given birth to this child, and Nancy writes, he took one look at its father, which is Boyd Dugdale, the awful old lecher, the lecherous lecher, and died. And I mean, it's very funny,
but cruel.
But yeah. Also, it's sort of a defensive thing, because for Nancy, losing babies was horrendous. The one thing Nancy, I think, really wanted and never had was a child. She had a lot of miscarriages, ectopic pregnancies, and she just never had that child. And so, in some ways, although she was a brilliant writer, her life was quite sad.
Yes. So, Francis, one thing that JLM, as I'm calling it, James Lees Milne, said in relation to Sydney, he called her Persephone, Queen of the Underworld.
Yes.
So what did he make of her then, as well as being Queen of the Underworld? What did he mean by that?
He adored her. She was, if I say withdrawn, she didn't fight the conversation to do all the jokes. I mean, for goodness sake, there were eight people present who were all very funny. But she could be funny herself. Her brother said she only made two jokes a year, but they were good ones. And I think he did fall in love with her a bit. But then a lot of the young men did. She was wonderfully good-looking and amazingly competent. I don't know why it makes me laugh so much that she was so successful with her eggs. You talk about the hens. But she was making £100 a year from her eggs. And in the 1930s, £100 was a very decent sum of money.
Before we move on to the less attractive sides of Sydney, and that is looming, we must address these. I just want to talk about one thing, which I know, Rachel, you and I are both very keen on talking about. And Frances, you've mentioned how beautiful they were. They also had the most extraordinary clothes. And this is not often talked about. Tell us about the fashion.
I think Nancy was just the most stylish person ever. And I think that's one of the reasons I sort of fell in love with her as a teenager. But Nancy is just really good about writing about clothes. It's so perfect, pitch perfect in Love in a Cold Climate, when she describes how Cedric, the very camp heir to the estate, makes over Lady Montdore and makes her so glamorous and slim, having been this frumpy old woman. So Nancy's brilliant on clothes and was clad in Dior. Of course, Jessica, I don't think, was as bothered about clothes, although Nancy marched off to Dior at some point to have a dress made. But Sydney loved clothes. And I think she passed that on to her daughters. I mean, it's not surprising, is it, if till you're 18 you're put in a sailor suit.
I remember Nancy saying later, when she was living in France and she was earning a lot of money, she said, oh, the wonderfulness, waking up in the morning and knowing you had something fairly new from Dior waiting for you to put it on.
Now, we do get on to the tougher part of the story of Sydney. Now, Rachel, you said it was very hard writing about a woman who held such appalling views. And you also said it was an emotional roller coaster writing this biography of Sydney. Tell us why, and very specifically, what were her views and how did they come about?
I think what I found hardest was the anti-Semitism. And the hardest bit was when I read a piece by her father, Thomas Gibson Bowles, who was a brilliant writer, as we've alluded to. But in his Log of the Nereid, he wrote the most hideous piece about going to Jerusalem and seeing refugees there, Jewish refugees. And I read it and I felt physically sick after reading it. And I had to weigh up, how much of this do we put in? How much do we not? And that, I think, influenced the family. I think Sydney was brought up in a household which was anti-Semitic. I mean, you can say it was around in Victorian times. It was in things like Fagin in Oliver Twist, Rider Haggard. A lot of Victorian literature had it in, but Thomas really sort of played on every trope. And then Sydney, I didn't find letters as much from her, but Nancy always implied that she was anti-Semitic. And Jessica also said, there's no getting away from the fact that in the 1930s, Sydney was aware of what was going on in Germany, because Jessica got the Brown Book of the Hitler Terror in the 1930s, which showed some of the atrocities that were happening and made sure her parents saw it and that Diana saw it. And then as time went on, Sydney didn't change her views, even when she knew about the Holocaust. She continued to admire Hitler. I couldn't really understand how this happened, and nor could a lot of her family. But it was as though she could not let go of her views. She always thought she was right, and anything else was propaganda. And because she was so blinkered about things and shut out things she didn't like, she blocked out the actual facts. Mm. And that's a failure of your moral compass. I couldn't explain that away.
Mm. Two of the daughters did then follow fascism and Hitler and Mosley, as we said at the beginning. How influential was she in forming their opinions?
We don't know that Sydney was as extreme, say, as Unity. I mean, Unity's views are on a whole nother scale. When she went to Germany, she was associating with the worst fascist and was writing letters to papers going, I'm a Jew hater. Appalling things, and showed such cruelty in her attitudes. You know, just before the war, Hitler found her a flat, and she knew that a young Jewish couple were going abroad on holiday, apparently, and she took it on. There's no excusing that. Diana had a more charming persona, and she held on to her views. I think she played down any anti-Semitism and would always say about Hitler, well, there are other dictators who've done genocide. That's not really an excuse, is it?
Well, we'll talk more about the books, the novels, in a few minutes. But to conclude Sydney's life, I suppose, I mean, she died in 1963 at the age of 83. How would you, did you like her in the end after spending all these years with her writing her biography?
That's a really interesting question. I didn't like her exactly, and I think if we'd met, would we have got on? But I found her fascinating. I was so interested because I wanted to trace how she got to where she was, and I felt able to do that.
Gail?
She had a really sad last few years, didn't she? Because, you know, her only son was killed in 1945 in Burma. Unity had shot herself and had to be nursed day and night.
By Sydney?
By Sydney. She and her husband separated. I mean, it you know, and she stuck with them. And
I mean, she's a heroine, I think, in that way.
In that way, yeah.
She was so resilient. She never moaned. And she did this triage of going from one person's crisis to another and was always there for them. So as a fellow mother, I liked her. Without her, the whole family would have completely fractured. And most of the girls by the end knew that. The one she continued to have a problem with was Nancy.
Yes. I think she had, you know, Hazel. Obviously a difficult marriage, wasn't it? I mean, to put it mildly. But I did find it, you know, sort of touching in a way that Favre obviously adored her, didn't he? And picture of him standing by her chair at night waiting for her to go up so he could run her bath and so on. So, you know, all sorts of
complicated
and sometimes conflicting almost picture of her you get as you...
They had conflicting political views, though, father and mother. So that's the reason they separated, wasn't it?
Well,
originally?
They separated in the war. And in the 30s, Favre had been right up there with Mab supporting Hitler. And in fact, he was right up to the war. Even after the Munich Agreement, he continued to support Hitler. But then suddenly, once war was announced, he did the patriotic thing and supported his country. And Nancy said he became the sort of most ardent opponent of Hitler. It wasn't just that, though, that came between them. He just couldn't cope with unity once she'd shot herself in the temple when she was in Germany. She came back to Britain brain damaged, was doubly incontinent, sort of messy, eating at mealtimes and embarrassing. And whereas Mav put up with it, looked after her, nursed her back to the highest level of health she could, and unity made quite a recovery. Favre couldn't cope at all and went off to live with the under-parlour maid in the Scottish house they owned on an island, leaving Muff to cope pretty much alone with her very disabled daughter.
There is no conclusion to this story, there really isn't. And of course, as you have mentioned, the Chatsworth archive will be opened in 2063.
I'd be a bit old for it then, I'll be in my 90s, so I might not do the revising.
You won't
revising.
Be able to revise your biography
me,
then.
Probably.
But I'm sure, as we've said early on, there's been so much written about them and there will continue to be. The novels, Nancy's novels and Jessica's books, now they weren't directly political. Jessica was much more political in her writing. So, Frances, how would you describe Nancy's novels in the context of this family?
Well, she was incredibly fortunate insofar as she had wonderful material in her family, and she had a first-class editor, Evelyn Waugh. And you think that's a racing start for any novelist. Her first few novels, which seem to have been written largely to have a swipe at her mother, are not good. The mother in the novels is ridiculed all the time. She's vague and ineffectual, and she's just a target for Nancy. That actually does go on in The Pursuit of Love and Love in a Cold Climate.
Now, these were written and published in 1945 and 49.
That's right. And the point is, they are so funny. And it's awful. I'm aware how much it makes one suspend judgment. Well, to my generation, I did try my daughter out on The Pursuit of Love, and she abandoned it after 30 pages, saying, "Mum, these are terrible people." And I don't know what it is about them. It is simply the humour, the quirkiness, the sarkiness that makes you actually love them so much. As I say, they still have the power to make me love.
Gail and Hazel and Rachel, do you think the novels, Nancy Mitford's novels, have stood the test of time?
Definitely.
Gail. Yes.
And Hazel.
One of my favourites is the third in the sort of series of post-war ones, and Don't Tell Alfred, set in the British Embassy in Paris, and this aristocrat comes to stay. I think she's based on Diana Cooper, I can't remember the fictional name, and basically sets up court in the embassy building, completely sidestepping the ambassador. And there are all sorts of comings and goings and things happening which are deeply unsuitable to a diplomatic mission. But it is, it's very funny.
It is very funny.
When they try to get rid of her, I recommend people read it because it's...
The sad thing about, I think, maybe in her final novel, The Blessing, they didn't sell well, and there is a note of bitterness in them. By then, the love of Nancy's life, when he was finally free of a sick wife, promptly married someone younger. And that, and the fact she suffered terribly in her later years from cancer, took the bloom off that humour. And She refers back even to her first book, The Pursuit of Love, what happened that Linda was so in love with this Duke with his banknotes. And she says quite casually in The Blessing, of course he was seeing someone else during the day. She's like a child kicking over sandcastles. And there's a great sadness in that, because the joie de vivre in the first two novels is so great, and I think that's what makes us pick them up again and again.
Now, Rachel, you had to read all the novels, I should imagine, and all the books, Jessica's and Nancy's and everybody else's. What do you make of the novels today?
I think that The Pursuit of Love really took off because she'd finally discovered love, true love, because of Gaston Pilecki, the free Frenchman she fell totally in love with. The other ones have got love stories in, and that doesn't work. They're just sort of nearly, well, they're not even nearly there. And then, as you say, I was rereading The Blessing actually last night for this. And that again is reflecting her love affair, because it's this woman who's gone to France and is married to this French aristocrat who's womanizing all the time. And she's so needy in it. And you very much get who Nancy is. For all the Mitfords, men were very, very important. You know, obviously, Diana Mosley left her very rich husband for Oswald Mosley. Jessica left home for Esmond Romilly. They were very male-dominated. And this came out in Nancy's writing. But as I say, stylistically, I think that The Pursuit of Love and Love, Nicole Clement are right up there with Evelyn Waugh or anyone.
I think
the others are not.
I agree.
They're inconsistent. But then all writers are inconsistent. I've written about people like Agatha Christie and Virginia Woolf, and they vary. You know, you're not always brilliant. There are some works that are much better than others.
So Nancy started writing at quite a young age. I mean, they were all writing, and as we say, they were self-educated and very creative women and girls. So how long did she continue writing? Because she wrote biographies and she translated.
Well, she needed to by the end.
So she was doing it to earn money.
Yes, she was. Mm. She was. If I can just once say, there's something about Nancy that touches me deeply. She conducted this vendetta against her mother for so long in print. And yet, her friends say she was obviously loved greatly by her mother. But the tragedy is she couldn't feel it. And I've met people like that. You can't square up the fact, of course she loves you. And the other person says, well, I've never felt it. And the fact was, she was loved, but for whatever reasons, she couldn't feel it.
I just want to mention Jessica, of course, and her books, because she was the second main writing sister. I mean, Nancy was the great novelist. Jessica wrote two quite well-known books, very well-known books, one published beautifully by Slightly Foxed. It's called Hons and Rebels by Jessica Mitford Decker. And this was a memoir of her early life before she went to live in California. Now, you've read this as well, Frances, and obviously you have Rachel too. What do you make of Jessica's style? She was, you know, obviously a very different person to Nancy.
She wrote very, very well. I'm not surprised she thought that science might have been her bent, because there's a great clarity in her writing and also a truthfulness. You believe what she's saying. It hasn't got the gloss and polish, but she doesn't necessarily want it to have. She's got a good story to tell and she tells it well. I'm afraid the hens are back with us again.
I know.
Because the Hons cupboard was originally the hens cupboard, and it was Hens and Rebels. But
There's a whole story behind this, which we haven't got time to go into, but the hens are there again.
Yes.
Now, this is one that you chose to publish, Gail and Hazel. Why did you choose this book by Jessica?
Well, I suppose it's a sort of true life version of The Pursuit of Love, really, but from a, you know, from a different perspective. And it is very, very funny. I mean, Jessica's running away. She starts a running away fund because she's desperate to leave home, and, you know, sort of keeps a record of every sort of extra sixpence or shilling that she gets given. And then when she does eventually run away, where she elopes with her cousin Esmond Romilly, and they go to Spain, that's very moving, an incredibly brave thing to do. And they have to be extracted rather ignominiously and brought back to England. But they, you know, they set up house in Rotherhithe, and then she gets pregnant and has a baby. And because her mother doesn't believe in doctors, that none of the girls were ever vaccinated. So Jessica catches measles, and then the baby does too, and the baby dies. It's a very moving story.
Hazel, sorry.
In a way, she's also sort of quite distanced, isn't she? Sort of private. You do feel these things for her, but when they went off to America after the baby died, I can't remember what the exact remark was, but, you know, we sort of fled.
Well, when they go, and then Esmond enlists in the Canadian Air Force, because America's not at war at that point, and is killed.
Now, Hons and Rebels was published originally in 1960, I recall. I know you've published it since in a really beautiful edition, which is the one I've read. And my feeling about that book is that it's, you know, it's very much a story of childhood and young adulthood. And what she is trying to do, what Jessica is trying to do, is to extricate herself from this family, which is very clear, which is why I think it's really interesting in the whole, if you like, the whole panoply of books about the Mitfords. You know, this is very different, I think. It's a different trajectory. And then her next book, her next well-known book, The American Way of Death, which is about the American funeral industry. I mean, lo and behold, very, very different. But again, she's moved on.
Yes.
This is her politics. This is her activism. She's basically left the family. And she didn't come back, did she, Rachel?
No, she didn't come back till 1955. But after that, she did want to come back quite a lot. And she actually got quite close to Mav or Sydney, having criticised her all her life. She suddenly said, actually, I became very, very fond of her. And reading the letters, there are a lot of similarities between mother and daughter. And they both had this incredible courage. Because the interesting thing about Jessica is that in her memoirs, she doesn't deal with tragedy. When her baby dies, Julia, she doesn't write in detail about that. When Esmond dies, she doesn't write about that. When she loses her son, Nicholas, so she has so much tragedy. And the Mitfords don't like dealing with that. They had a concrete upper lip, as someone once said. You know, they just didn't show it. They'd have humour, but you just don't discuss feelings. You don't deal with that. And Diana talked about that too and said, actually, we were sort of taught to put on such a mask that they couldn't even let it down sometimes among themselves or each other. So they don't do feelings in depth in any of the writing.
What a family. And as you can tell, we could talk for much, much longer. Just before we finish talking about Mitfords, I do want to bring up another few books and biographies on the Mitfords, because these are really important. And I know, Rachel, you know, you've read, both of you, Frances and Rachel, have read very widely on the subject. And there's Mary Lovell's The Mitford Girls, the biography of an outrageous family. That was the first big biography, 2002. And then James Lees Milne Diaries, which Frances has referred to. And then The Mitfords, Letters Between Six Sisters, which I think all of us have probably dipped into at some point. It's a collection of all six sisters' letters to each other and edited by Diana's daughter-in-law, Charlotte Moseley. And then more recently, Carla Kaplan's biography of Jessica Mitford, Troublemaker. Now, we've all read all of these books, and I imagine that the Mitford book industry will continue, but also all the TV adaptations, the films and so on. I saw a wonderful serialisation called Outrageous, which was on BBC. We all saw that, I think. Rachel, you loved it too. I remember we talked about it, didn't we, when we first met?
Yeah, yes. I mean, I loved it. Let's go back to the clothes, because I met someone who was a costume designer for it, and she said, yeah, you know, Unity's dresses, they even had swastikas on the buttons. They were so accurate.
On that happy note, maybe not happy note, but controversial note, but it's all been a mixture of controversial and extremely entertaining and interesting. So thank you so much to Rachel Trethewey, and congratulations on your, as I say, magnificent biography of Sydney Mav, and Frances, for your absolutely invaluable input and knowledge of the Mitford novels and of the family and so on. Thank you, Frances Donnelly, very much as well. Now stay with us, because we're going to be talking to Gail and Hazel with some of their recommendations just after this small trailer about Slightly Foxed. Slightly Foxed is a small independent publishing house in Hoxton, East London. It was founded in 2004 by two editors, Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood, as a labour of literary love. Slightly Foxed publishes a quarterly magazine which appeals to passionate readers everywhere who enjoy engaging with a wide range of excellent writing, past and present, fiction and non-fiction. Slightly Foxed champions the lost, lesser-known or forgotten literary gems and celebrates the offbeat and unusual. Its contributors are also an eclectic bunch. Some are well-known novelists, distinguished journalists or academics. Others come from very different walks of life. Slightly Foxed also regularly reissues out-of-print books that deserve new audiences. The quarterly magazine has a global readership and is always happy to welcome more readers. It's posted out four times a year to over 60 countries. You can take out an annual subscription at a very reasonable rate, and this also gives you free access to all the back issues and the whole digital archive. That's well over 1,200 articles. If you'd like to subscribe, do visit our website, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd prefer to talk to a human being in the office, then phone us in the London office. Contact details are on the website. Today, the Slightly Foxed family comprises magazines, books, newsletters, the annual Reader's Day, and our podcast. Do join us. So, Gail and Hazel, have you got some recommendations, some additional recommendations for us this
time? We have indeed. And my recommendation, I spoke earlier about us reissuing R.C. Sheriff's No Leading Lady, his autobiography. And I said that he's best known for Journey's End, but the other book that he's best known for, which was a bestseller, it's called The Fortnight in September, and it's been reissued by Persephone. And it is the most enchanting story of a family of five, the Stevens, who live in Dulwich in South London. And every September, they go on holiday to Bognor by the sea. It starts off, Mr. Stevens has a marching orders, which he has perfected over the years. And who is going to see to the cat? Who is going to take the canary round to the neighbour to be looked after? Who is going to cancel the order for milk and newspapers? Who is going to remember to lock the loo window? And off they go. A porter from the station comes to collect their luggage, and they stay in a boarding house run by Mrs. Huggett. Mr. Huggett drank himself to death, but Mrs. Huggett is still soldiering on, but sadly the boarding house is looking a bit ropey around the edges. And it's
boarding
just...
Boarding houses always do in novels, don't they?
I've never been in one, so I don't know.
But well, in novels they always look ropey around the edges.
But it's just, nothing much happens, and I think it's a reflection of Sheriff's character that he can make the ordinary and the mundane comforting and fascinating. So I do recommend it. I'm reading it for the second time and still loving it. So
well, and I will read it for the first time because this is what happens. I get these wonderful recommendations from you both, books I haven't, or authors I haven't heard of before. Hazel, have you got one for us?
Yes, well, I've been reading this actually quite short novel by Anne Tyler called 3 Days in June. And I haven't read Anne Tyler before. Shocking
My
thought.
My goodness, a sharp intake of breath here, yes.
Neither have I, Hazel, if it's any consolation.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
I was just very taken with it. It's about the 3 days of a daughter's wedding, and the novel opens with Gail, who is a teacher, actually being given the push, basically, in her 60s by the head. She was expecting to become head when the head retired at her school, her posh private school, but then she's told that quite tactfully in a way, but that she doesn't really have quite the social skills required and somebody else is being flowed in. So this is on the very eve of her daughter's wedding. So you immediately get a picture of Gail. She is kind of awkward, terribly likable, but she doesn't quite see what she's doing that's wrong. And it takes you through the 3 days of the daughter's wedding and the drama when it's discovered that Kenneth might have been having an affair with somebody else, actually. And it's just very, very subtly done. She's such a wonderful depictor of character, isn't she? You totally believe in these people.
But it's interesting and probably a great gift that you are reading Anne Tyler for the first time.
Yes.
I've read a number of them, starting for me with Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant, and How about you, Frances?
Well, she's one of my great heroines.
She's amazing, isn't she?
And she is amazing. Mm. And for those who haven't read her, remember the number 8. She wrote 8 novels before she wrote Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant, and which are perfectly fine, clever, quirky. She was learning her trade. Novels 8 to 16 are her great novels. Mm. Now, even the one you're reading now is a novel at the end of her life, and it's not as substantial as some of her books.
She's in her 80s.
That's right. She's allowed to.
Yes.
Every fair, absolutely. From fair, sometimes yes. declines. She's allowed to. And she's chosen to live in a senior citizen's gated enclosure rather than with her family, so she can go on with her writing. She is a wonderful writer. I feel profoundly grateful to have been able to read her. She's meant a great deal to me in my life.
Well, I think that's an article for Slightly Foxed in the making,
just,
Frances.
Yes. I mean, Anne Tyler is definitely one of my great heroines. Well, 2 wonderful recommendations, and I will read yours, Gail, for the first time, and I will totally endorse Hazel's Anne Tyler novel because I just love Anne Tyler. So thank you so much to Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood, to my producer, Philippa Goodrich, and the whole team here at Slightly Foxed. And thank you again to Rachel Trithewey and Frances Donnelly. That's it for this episode, and see you in 3 months' time for yet more compelling stories and storytellers and riveting tales. You'll find all the books and authors we've discussed today in the programme show notes, which you can easily access on your podcast app or the Foxed website, foxedquarterly.com. And that's where you can also subscribe to our quarterly print magazine. Print or podcast. All of us at Slightly Foxed are united in our love of books and of great authors, past and present, in reading the best contemporary literature and in rediscovering those lost and forgotten literary gems. My name is Rosie Goldsmith, and thank you so much for joining us.